would have absolutely enjoyed the country fair. I remember the old days of before the Southeastern Fair just became a totally lost and wasted, that there was a time when it was just a kid's delight. You go to the fair, and this could be, I'm sure, duplicated in your experience, has been duplicated when you've had trips to the county fair, where you would have, in the first place, you have all these different kinds of foods laid out before you. You've got all kinds of ice cream and homemade ice cream and cotton candy and those dishes and desserts and those pies and everything that could reflect the best, the state of the art in cooking. And then you had all the games that before you, and if you just had a few dollars in your pocket, you could roam around with your eyes just darting everywhere. Your blood is racing. You're excited. Where do I begin to spend my money? Then, of course, you had in the livestock section. That always fascinated me. Those the determining of with the blue ribbons or white ribbons or red ribbons, what would be the most the best of the flock, of the herd, the squared shoulders of the cow, or the milk, or the wool, or whatever it is that the animals were there on display and were judged for their quality. And then you had all of the rides. You know, as the sun went down and as the rides came alive and the lights came on and the Ferris wheel and the merry-go-round, it was like just a fantasy world. All the smells and the excitement. I believe Solomon would have really have loved the country fair. And he would have, it offers to us, I think, essentially what a Solomon is doing in this book of Ecclesiastes, at this second chapter in Ecclesiastes. That Solomon is self-consciously, he is engaging in an experiment. And his experiment is to go through everything that life has to offer to try to find if that's going to give him his ultimate meaning, if that's going to define the reason for his existence and define his purpose in life. Why? What is the ultimate good? Or as the philosophers refer to this as the summum bonum. What is the ultimate good? Why are we here? Well, Solomon would have, as I suggest to you, would have enjoyed the country fair, because it is this point in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 that he had his own country fair. Let's follow with me as I read verses 1 to 11, and you're going to see this its next experiment that Solomon's engaging in. Now, I want to remind you that Solomon, up to this point, he's shown us that life's ultimate meaning cannot be found in nature or wisdom. That he's already gone through in the first chapter, though he's going to go back to those themes in subsequent chapters, that you cannot find out there in nature, in the environment, the key that's going to unlock the mysteries of life. That God has created nature. God has given it to us. It's His gift. But you will not find you will not define your purpose for living by becoming somehow harmonious with nature. There is, in the New Age movement today, there is that commitment to finding one's meaning by becoming perfectly attuned with nature. If we can just learn how to live with our environment, then this somehow defines our existence. Solomon says, no, you're not going to find it there. It's not in the genetic code. It's not in physics. It's not in space exploration. As Carl Sagan would have us to believe that if we could just get one message from somewhere in outer space, that will be our hope for our future existence. Just one message. And then Solomon tells us that wisdom also is the intellect, the pursuit of knowledge is not going to give to you or to me the meaning and significance of life. Now, he has an experiment that he's going to pursue now. It's the country fair experiment. It's pleasure. Now, follow with me as you can see this unfold in the second chapter. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. At the very outset, Solomon tells us what his experiment is going to be. And of all the people on the face of the earth, no one has ever had the opportunities that Solomon did to explore this area of pleasure. We'll see this unfold in these few verses, and we'll go to Kings to look at some of the qualifications that Solomon had for finding this area of pleasure to be really a cul-de-sac, a dead-end street. Because he does go on and give us his verdict, doesn't he? He said, all right, I thought in my heart that there is some calculated plan here that I will test you with pleasure. Now, let me remind you that Solomon is showing us that he's not going to go into the kind of pleasure seeking that is just eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow you die, where you just satiate yourself with everything, every pleasure possible, to the point where it is debilitating and destructive. He's not talking about some sort of suicide by just over-drinking and overeating and gluttony. No, he's going to go at it more like the Epicurean, where you simply seek to sample the best. And so it's a controlled experiment. And he's going to go through this controlled experiment to see if maybe pleasure. For all, it's easy to understand, isn't it, how that you might think pleasure would be the defining reason for our existence. Well, the reason for that is because we can find satisfaction in pleasure more so than in wisdom. It's a little more readily available. You know, with wisdom, if you're going to try to find it in the intellect, you've got to research, you've got to study, you've got to read. You may have to go to a lot of years of higher education, and it requires a lot of work if you're going to try to find the answer in philosophy and just mastering all of the sciences and seeing if the answer is there. That's work. But you know, pleasure is not, it's as immediate and as close as the next good feeling. And a good feeling can be easy to come by. But watch his verdict here in these first two verses. He said, but that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? So he tells us at the very outset that it's a dead-end street. He's telling us, I set out to find out if pleasure was all it was cracked up to be. Now, I hope this will save you some heartache. Look, I may be speaking to some this morning, and you're going to try this. You're going to try to find your meaning in life based upon feel good, the feel goods. If it feels good, it must be right. If I can just live a life where I'm satisfying myself and enjoying the pleasures of this life, that's where it is. Partying. Oh yeah, I want to just party. Now there's that time of life when a child comes out of adolescence and gets into the late teens and early 20s. And then all of a sudden, there is a world that opens up for them, potentially. And it can be drink, it can be drugs, it can be sex, and partying. And so Solomon can save you some heartache, if you'll listen to him. He'll save you some heartache. Think, well, I'll find my purpose in life by just being a party animal. Psalm says, I was a party animal. I want to save you some heartbreak. Will you listen to me? So he's given his verdict. Now what we're going to see him do in this experiment is that he's going to show us that pleasure does have some attraction. What is the attraction of pleasure? Well, let's pick it up and see in verse 3. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. See, Solomon says, listen, I didn't throw good judgment overboard with this experiment. So I'm not going out. He doesn't go out here with just reckless abandon to wine, women, and song without regard to what it would do to him physically. This is a controlled experiment. I mean, the man's smart. And that's what he's telling us. He's telling us that my mind guided me with wisdom through this. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. Now, let me pause here to show you some of the qualifications that Solomon had for exploring this area of pleasure. Now, hold your place in Ecclesiastes, and I'm going to have you go over to 1 Kings. We're going to be looking at several places there in 1 Kings. 1 Kings and the 4th chapter. Notice the ways in which Solomon could indulge himself and did indulge himself. 1 Kings chapter 4, and we'll pick it up at the 22nd verse. Now, this is the kind of life that Solomon lived. And there was a party going on 24 hours a day in the palace. Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. That's somewhere around 365 bushels. 10 head of stall-fed cattle. 20 of pleasure pasture-fed cattle, and 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl. So if you had gone to the table of Solomon, the banquet table, you would have had any meat, any kind of this would be a culinary delight set out on that table. What kind of meat is this? What kind of meat is that? Well, I'll tell you, you would have seen the choicest of beef. They would have been on this table. They would have been prime rib. Then there'd been pheasant under glass. Where in the world do I begin? Well, he says that he ruled over the kingdoms of west of the river from Tipsha and to Gaza and had peace on all sides. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel from Dan to Beersheba lived in safety, every man under his vine and fig tree. Solomon had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses and 12,000 horses. So Solomon had the experience of all of this 24-hour party that was going on in his banquet hall in the palace. He had all of the military armaments that a king would have in violation, of course, to the king's standards, God's standards for the kings. And verse 27, the district officers, each in his month, supplied provisions for the king of Solomon. And all who came to the king's table, they saw to it that nothing was lacking. They also brought to the proper place their quotas of barley and straw for the chariot horses and for other horses. So Solomon would have had an unlimited opportunity to go through this exploration of pleasure. Now, let me show you something else in 1 Kings in chapter 7. If you go down just a chapter or two, come down to 1 Kings 7. This palace that Solomon built, it took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete the construction of his palace. He built the palace of the forest of Lebanon, 100 cubits long and 50 wide and 30 high, with four rows of cedar columns supporting trimmed cedar beams. It was roofed with cedar above the beams that rested on the columns, 45 beams, 15 to a row. Its windows were placed high in sets of three, facing each other. All the doorways had rectangular frames. They were in the front part in the sets of three, facing each other, and on and on and on and on. Notice down in the ninth verse, and all these structures from the outside to the great courtyard, from the foundation to the eaves, were made of blocks of high grade stone cut to size. So Solomon had not only all of these food delights, he also had the delight of construction and creativity and projects that were going on constantly. If you will, look back in the second chapter of Ecclesiastes, and I'll show you these projects. Look in the fourth verse. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself, planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. Ancient kings have always reveled in these gardens, and you'll find that it seems to have been a hallmark of royalty that if you could afford it, you would build just elaborate gardens. You can see this in Versailles in France and the Louis XIV and the kings of France, and you can see it in English, the great English gardens and of the kings and the queens of England. And wherever you go with and you find monarchies that have had almost limited access to workers and to money, that they reveled in building these elaborate gardens. And in Babylon, in Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, he constructed this huge, what is the seventh wonder of the world. It was this, he made a mountain for his homesick Median wife. And he made a mountain right in the city, and it had the famous hanging gardens. And it was terraced with all of these various exotic plants, and all the flora and the fauna was brought in, and with water that was through a sophisticated hydraulic system, the water was brought up to keep this thing well watered, and it was just a beautiful, beautiful sight. Well, Solomon had all of these projects around him, and he says further that I brought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also own more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers. So he had muzak constantly. I mean, one bank, a party going on all the time. Projects going. Project for this, a project for reservoirs and aqueducts and buildings. And he said that I had a harem as well, and the delights of the heart of men. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Not 700 wives and 300 concubines and mistresses. So you can see that Solomon had all of this just cornucopia of material pleasures at his disposal. Now let me take you back to 1 Kings, and I'll show you another example of this. Go back to 1 Kings 9 and verse 15. 1 Kings 9:15. Notice here's the account of the forced labor King Solomon conscripted to build his Lord's temple in his own palace and the supporting terraces. And Solomon built all this. He built up the lower Beth Horon in verse 18 and 19. It says that, come back up to verse 13. What kind of towns are these you have given me, my brother, he asked. And he called of the land of Kabul in the name of, they say, now Hiram had sent to the king 120 talents of gold. Now I want to show you the amount of income that Solomon had just from gold itself. Look in 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 14 and 21. The weight of the gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents. Now, don't make any hermeneutical leaps into the revelation and think there's some prophetical significance to this. There's not. It just so happens that this is the number of the weight of the money, of the gold, not including the revenues from merchants and traders and from all the Arabian kings and governors on the land. You know, this comes out to something like 25 tons of gold. I mean, he had $250 million of annual income just from gold. Not counting revenue from everything else that was coming into him. And notice in the 21st verse, 1 Kings chapter 10, all King Solomon's goblets were gold. And all the household articles in the palace of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Nothing was made of silver, because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's days. Well, excuse me. It was just like rocks on the ground. He said the king had a fleet of trading ships at sea along with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years it returned carrying gold and silver, ivory and apes and baboons. So he had a zoo brought in for him. He had music. He had wine, women, song, everything imaginable. Listen, Solomon can save you a lot of heartache, folks, because he said, I have the resources to explore these areas. And we've got to come to the judgment on them. Come back with me to Ecclesiastes. Look at Ecclesiastes and chapter 2, and notice in the ninth verse, the end of the eighth verse. I amassed silver and gold for myself, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers, and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. Now, what may we say then about pleasure's attraction? Pleasure does offer to excite our senses, doesn't it? You can see why this is such an appealing area for experimentation to try to find your meaning in life. Because God made us to enjoy things. He gave us our senses. He gave us the eyes to see and delight in beautiful things. He gave us the eye to look out on the morning light when the air is particularly clear and crisp and you can watch the sun come in the green of the trees and the grass. It just looks like almost emerald-like. And He gave us these taste buds to enjoy a sweet grape, to enjoy a nice, crisp, delicious apple, to enjoy a nice glass of beverage. He gave us the ability to smell and to enjoy the honeysuckle and the sweet shrub. And, you know, the Lord gave us these senses to enjoy. And there's nothing wrong with enjoying things. And Solomon is not having us here to, would not have us look at life and say, well, it's all useless in the sense that God doesn't want us to enjoy any of the pleasures of life. He is saying that if you make the pleasures of life the means by which you try to find your purpose for living, it's a cul-de-sac. It's a dead-end street. But pleasure does offer to excite our senses. Is there anything wrong with pleasure in itself? No, there is not. But we weren't made to find fulfillment in pleasure. God gave us the taste buds. He gave us the smell, the sense of smell and sight and taste and touch and hearing and all of this. And that satisfaction of getting into projects and seeing something that's built and done and that's the way we are. God made us that way. You go out and whether it's cutting your lawn or building a room in the basement or building a house or painting or working on an automobile and getting it repaired. You know, we've got, all of us have different interests and different skills. But you know that joy that comes from having some project, some goal, and then standing back and then looking at it and being satisfied with it. You did a good job. It was a fulfilling thing. God made us that way. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, having said that, though, we must say this about the nature of pleasure and how it has a limitation on it. Solomon wants us to understand that really we're limited because of the brevity of life. These bodies can only bear so much, can't they? They can only bear so much pleasure. They have a way of wearing down, and is what we're going to see later on in the book of Ecclesiastes. Your capacity to enjoy the sense through the sense of smell, after a while, so many years, you know, you can't smell all the smells that you used to smell. You can't taste everything that you used to taste. You can't hear everything that you used to hear. You can't see everything as crisply and as well as you used to. So the body betrays us because of its own, the fact that we're locked into our mortality. And what he's pointing out through this is that there is the brevity of life that limits the ability to enjoy, to find one's pleasure and to find pleasure in life by enjoying things. Pleasure offers us escape from the routine. Isn't that why it's such an alluring thing? It takes us out of the ordinary. Food and drink and projects and creativity and sex and music. These are the things that Solomon mentions here. That these projects, and they're not all just purely sensuous. He mentions just a whole host of things that bring one pleasure through the experience. But you can, I think, see that pleasure does offer some legitimate attractions. And whether it is a good meal, that, you know, some people find that this is their only pleasure in life is perhaps a good, tasty meal. And some people, of course, have found that The one thing they can always count on is that food is going to never betray them, and food is going to be a good friend to them. But Solomon would have us to know this, that though it may provide you a nice meal or some building project may provide escape from the routine of life, yet pleasure has deception. There are deceptions. Yes, it promises a break from the routine. You can excite your taste buds. You can enjoy the satisfaction of engaging in work and carrying out your skills if you're an artist or if you're a musician or whatever it is that God has given to you to do. However, there are some deceptions. What are these deceptions? Look in the 9th and to the 11th verses and you'll see this. Solomon says, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem. He was a VIP. He was known all over the world. They wanted to do a special on the rich and famous. Oh, this was the man to come and to see. The rich and the famous before me said, I was greater than anyone in Jerusalem. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. They said, I didn't lose my ability to see what was valuable, what was invaluable, what was not valuable, what would be harmful to me, what would be helpful to me. He said, I kept a clear head through it all. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward of all my labor. Yet, there are some deceptions that go with the experiment of pleasure. If you think that the purpose in life is to feel good and avoid pain, Solomon wants you to understand this. Pleasure promises what it cannot provide. It really puts a band-aid on a tumor. My longings, the longings I have for satisfaction and pleasure, that the desires that God has given to me, cannot be focused upon things and the satisfaction of that comes from indulging in those things, that it comes how? Well, we're going to build to that, but I want you to see that pleasure promises what it can't provide. It seems to tickle the human spirit. It can't go through its depths. It's like, let's go to the second issue. It's so only temporary. It's like trying to eat just one salty peanut. You try to just eat one, and you're tempted. You got to have, what is the commercial? You can't eat just one. You got to have more. Pleasure is only temporary. It demands repetition. You got to keep coming back for more. That is, you can see this in terms of why people who've tried to find pleasure in our hedonistic society. Hedonism is a world and life view that dominates in this Western civilization. And where hedonism is, and this is not exactly what Solomon was experimenting with, but there's a relationship. Hedonism seeks to avoid, to indulge in all pleasure, and that the good in life is pleasure, and that the evil in life is pain. So you want to avoid the pain and seek the pleasure, and if it feels good, you know, you do it. And good feelings are the standard of the criteria. That would be the summum bonum that many believe, the highest good for which we should live, to affirm ourselves with good feelings. Solomon tells us that pleasure is only temporary. You're always having to go back for more. And then in the third place, the pursuit of pleasure results in either boredom or frustration. That you find this true with those who have the money and the wherewithal to seek out all of these experiments in terms of food and drink and excitement and travel and building projects, and they can do anything they want to, can travel anywhere they want to, but this just seems to be never enough. It's always got to come back to more and something different. And the reason is that this pleasure, the pursuit of pleasure, results in boredom and frustration. Notice in verse 11, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Now, if you would like to find some project that could be rather vaporous and rather pointless, just go out here and watch the way the wind is blowing and try to chase it down. And see if you can grab it. And if you get a handle on it, and you can stop it, and you can control it. Solomon said that's the way it is when you try to define your purpose and meaning in life through the pursuit of pleasure. He says that nothing was gained under the sun. It was all a dead-end street. And you know what Solomon would tell us if he were here to talk to us? Solomon would tell us about his greater son. Solomon would tell us that if you really want to find the pleasure and meaning in life that you desire, that you're going to have to do this. That true happiness in life comes how? It comes through sharing Christ's suffering. And this is the Christian paradox. Christians are not against pleasure. Christians are not against happiness. Someone has defined, you know, the cynical crowd tries to define Puritans as those people who are having a good time somewhere. That the world will try to put that mask upon Christians, and some Christians, I think, earn that criticism. But if Christianity is not set against pleasure and satisfaction and happiness, but rather it's this, it's paradoxical. That what Solomon would tell us through his greater son, Jesus Christ, is that if you want to enjoy the ultimate satisfaction in life, if you really want pleasure to be enhanced in the fullest sense, it comes how? Through relationship. Listen to where the Lord began. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Where do you have to start? You start with poverty. A sense of poverty. Your helplessness, your need. Blessed are those that mourn, for they shall be comforted. See, there's the grief over your sin. See, my friend, the answer to find meaning in life is not a shopping spree at the mall. No, there are people who get into that kind of effort to try to deal with their personal problems. If I can just have a credit card and be turned loose at the mall, shop until I drop. Well, Solomon would stop and would tell us, no, wait a minute. If you're trying to use pleasure, whatever form you want to pursue it, to anesthetize you to your struggles and problems, you've got to realize that the only way that you're ever going to define yourself and define your purpose in life is that you've got to identify with Christ's sufferings. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Well, you go through the Beatitudes, you can see that it comes through identifying with the sufferings of Jesus Christ. And that happiness, true happiness, comes through serving Christ's purposes. Do you recall what Jesus said in Matthew 6? He said, after all these things, the pagans run after. What things? Food and shelter and clothing. To try to have a better home, to try to have the best of foods, the best of clothes, the best that like the good life, to try to have it. But Jesus went on to say this. Jesus said this, that the pagans run after these things, and your Father knows that you have need of them. So the Lord's not indifferent to the fact that He's made us a certain way to enjoy a good warm home, a comfortable home, to enjoy a good food and drink and comfortable clothing. He said He knows you have these need of these things. But then what does He say in verse 33? Seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and these things will be added unto you. The Lord will take care of those pleasures, but pleasures come as a consequence. Happiness comes as a consequence of pursuing the purposes of Christ. And identifying with the sufferings of Christ is then the key to experiencing the true meaning in life. It's through a relationship, intimacy. You know, this is why hedonism in whatever form that it takes, if it is the pursuit of, let's say, sexual lust. Sexual lust has a way of diminishing one's capacity for genuine intimacy with other people, and above all, for diminishing one's capacity for intimacy with God. You have a society which is lust-driven, and where lust is just constantly appealed to and worked on in the movies and on television, and you're always kept at that excited level. There's always has to be something more. You know, it's no accident that television every year degenerates and it's worse than the next year, than the year before. Why? Well, the same sort of titillation won't work in the programs that worked last fall or the fall before that. There'll have to be something even more. You'll have to get more the previews that come. I mean, how many different ways can you appeal and entice your audience to come and watch some fornication, adultery? It takes more and more and more of it. So that's the point that Solomon is making here, is saying that for a society that seeks to live out its purpose in life, find its purpose through pleasure, it's self-seeking, it's debilitating, it'll destroy you. Intimacy with God in relationship with Jesus Christ come through identifying with His sufferings. What did Paul say in Philippians in chapter 3? Paul said, I want to know Christ and the power of the resurrection and what? Sharing in the fellowship of His sufferings. The death of Christ. So it's paradoxical. If you want to experience your purpose in life, you have to come and identify with a suffering Jesus Christ. And in identifying with a suffering Jesus Christ and experiencing that intimacy and relationship with Him, and a love relationship is established, that's then the way that true happiness comes and finds its place in your life. My friend, I'm appealing to you here. Solomon can save you a lot of heartache. I think of some of you young people that you think that you are going to... You have had perhaps a jaundiced experience growing up, and you see yourself as having been deprived of certain pleasures, and that if you can experience those pleasures and get away from mom and dad and the boundaries that have been set, that you're going to find your meaning and purpose in life. Solomon would say to you, no, no, no. It comes only through this living, abiding relationship with Jesus Christ. My dear young friend, I want to tell you that what may be going on in your own heart and your dissatisfaction with Christianity, it could very well be that you have really never learned what it means to own the Lord for yourself and to know Him in that personal way, where His Word and in fellowship with Him is an exciting, ongoing relationship in your life. But I'm telling you again, I'll tell you again, Solomon says, listen, I've tried all these pleasures. You don't have the money. You don't have the time. You don't have the resources to try everything Solomon did. And Solomon said, it's a cul-de-sac. And what you're going to do, you probably won't have the sense that Solomon did, because it was a controlled experiment. You and I will do something crazy. We'll go out and we'll think that, to sample all kinds of alcoholic beverages and drugs, that'll satisfy me. And then you end up in a rehab program somewhere. Solomon didn't have to go to a rehab program. So you won't do it like Solomon. But he is telling you, listen, you will find it through Solomon's greater son. Find what? You'll find your meaning and your purpose in life. Let me pray with you. Do you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Jesus Christ is your Savior from sin? Have you come to the foot of the cross and let that heavy burden of sin roll off your back and down that hill into that empty tomb? And have you walked away from that cross with a liberating experience of coming to know all of your sins forgiven, and that you've got eternal life in Jesus Christ? Oh, my friend, I'm here to tell you that Solomon's greater son, Jesus Christ, provides for you and for me the very reason for our existence. He is the reason for our existence. We were made for Him. We were not made for pleasure for pleasure's sake. We were made for God. And then as we find God and know Him, then the pleasure comes and takes its proper place. Do you know that? Father, I pray for the sense that we need about this, that Your Word has been so clear through this experiment of Solomon. We might know Christ in the power of the resurrection, in the fellowship of His sufferings. Keep us from falling, Lord, into that idolatry of making our own feelings, making them the ultimate standard for good. Keep us from falling and give us that discernment that comes from this look in this portion of Your Word. For we ask in Christ's name. Amen. I want to encourage you to come back this evening with the Old National Christian Academy Choir. Is going to be with us, and we're going to be in Hebrews and the 11th chapter and looking for the city. We're going to go out looking for a city tonight, so we have that provided. And remember, choir's at 5:30 this evening, so you're dismissed. We've got lunch downstairs that's provided, so make your way down the back, either set of steps, and...